Hi friends, it's Brittany. Before we dive into today's episode, I have a quick ask for you. I need your help. I'm doing a short listener survey to get to know you a little bit better. Who's tuning in? What do you love? And how I can keep Conscious Pathways fresh, meaningful, and aligned with what you need. It won't take more than 5 minutes, and your feedback means so much to me. It helps me grow and helps this podcast to grow with you. You'll find the link in the show notes, and I would be so grateful if you took a moment to share your thoughts. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening. And now let's get into the episode. Hey, welcome back to Conscious Pathways. I'm your host, Brittany Carey. Today, I have an amazing guest for us. I have Dr. Erica Dallas joining us. She's here to talk about culturally responsive, relevant, and sustaining pedagogy, particularly in early childhood education. We really dive in deep into culture, into inclusive practices, into diverse classrooms. We dive into some of the challenges in implementing these type of pedagogies in the classroom. As always, we wrap up the conversation talking about how we reimagine education, what that future of education looks like. I'm so excited to share this conversation with you. I know I learned a bunch just during this conversation. So let's get right into it. Welcome, welcome to the podcast. Today I have Dr. Erica Dallas with me today.
Thank you.
Is that the first time that someone's like officially addressed you this way?
It is. It is the first time. But for the record, you can call me Erica, but Dr. Dallas sounds really good. It is the first time. It's also new and fresh.
Yes, yes. You just did it on Wednesday, right?
Yes, yes, nice. Yes. I needed a moment for it to all soak in, and I posted it on Facebook, but I haven't heard anyone say it verbally, except for during my final oral defense. They said it at the end, but actually, you know, like someone outside of school, you're the first.
Yes. Well, for the audience to know, do you want to tell us a little bit about what we are talking about?
Absolutely. So we're talking about culturally responsive, relevant, and sustaining pedagogy in preschool settings, and matter of fact, in all settings, but I specialize in early childhood education. So that setting would specifically be like a preschool setting or ECE setting, childcare settings. Yeah.
Amazing. So one question I always want to start out with my guests is to really kind of get to know you, get to know how you got started, is to just tell me a little bit about your journey in education. What inspired you to join the education field?
I would say, I think that everything happens for a reason. So it all started when I was younger. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and I went to public schools in Cleveland, Ohio. And so my experience in the public school system was really, really hard. There was a lack of cultural relevancy of my culture. I identify as African-American Black. So going to schools, it was just a lack of, and I didn't understand that until I got older and I started experiencing university life. And I realized that there was a void when I was younger, and that's why I didn't excel academically. And also my mom worked at the Boys and Girls Club. So she was in the education department. So I used to go to work with her. And I always wanted to I either wanted to be a police officer or a teacher. And I studied criminal justice, and it just wasn't for me. So I decided that working with children as early on, before they even get into the K-12 system, is the best way to approach a positive approach to their learning and acquiring these skills that they need to succeed in school, because I didn't have that. So I guess it all stemmed from me growing up and not having something. And then as I got older, I realized the void, and I never wanted anyone else to experience that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I know when I think back, kind of similar, when I think back to my early education experiences, I think even throughout my entire like kind of K-12 experience, I think I only had two Black teachers, and one was a Black woman, and that was it.
Yeah, see?
That was all I had. That was all I saw.
You know, even when I did have Black teachers, they were not, I think they were like sort of programmed into doing a specific thing because they were the only Black teacher at the school. So they had to, in order to keep your job, in order to stay, they had to fit this kind of criteria. And that's what I experienced. My first negative experience was with an African-American teacher who really didn't identify with her culture, her ethnicity, her race, her nationality. So, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's hard, and it's really confusing, especially as a young person, you know, and you're coming into recognizing your own kind of racial identity and what that means and what that looks like. And you're getting a lot of, especially as a child, you get a lot of that information from your peers and the adults around you. So you're really doing a lot of observations and really learning from how other people are interacting and how other people are talking about it. And when you have those experiences, one, it's really confusing.
It is.
As a child who's like, wait a minute.
And it sets the stage.
Yes.
It sets the stage for the rest of your life. Those experiences that you can remember, it sets the stage for everything else that you experience in the school environment. So she set the stage because I'm still able to remember those instances and those situations. And then from there, it just went downhill. I had all the rest of my teachers, except for one, I had all Caucasian teachers. And so it just went downhill from there, but she set the stage and I'm like, hey, you identify as me. You look like me. What? What? Not really look like me because I'm really high yellow, but but you know how that goes. So it kind of, you know, put a little void in my life and it lasted for a long time.
Yes. And would you say that most of your kind of experiences in either K-12 education or, you know, before college and all of that, would you say most of that was in kind of PWIs or primarily predominantly white institutions?
Yes. So I was a part of I don't know if your listeners know what this was, but I was a part of the busing system. And so the busing system was set in place to integrate schools with African-American students. And then in some places, they would integrate schools with Caucasian or white students, depending on who signed up. But then they had some that were forced bused. Well, I was a part of the forced and sign up. My mom didn't really understand, but she signed me up. So I was one of those students who got bused an hour and a half to the west side of Ohio, to the white neighborhoods. I went to a Claire U. Westrop and it was all white school. So it was a cultural shock for me. All of the teachers were white. And I would say my second year, that the experience that all of the African-American students that got bused there had, it was just horrible. It was horrible. It was horrible. We could realize that it was horrible. The teachers could realize that it was horrible. So they started bringing in my second year, they started bringing in African-American teachers. And so then my second experience with an African-American teacher was a male, Mr. Pugh, and he was down to earth. He let us know, I know what you're going through. I've had to live through this. I've experienced this. We're going to do this. We're going to make it. He was so positive and he was amazing. And then he got terminated. So my experiences were all with white teachers. And I'm honestly, they were very heart-wrenching. Yeah. Very heart-wrenching. Yeah.
And that's understandable. I think that kind of segues into kind of our topic for this today's episode is that culturally relevant, responsive, sustaining pedagogy. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about how kind of your discovering of this, how you kind of found this type of pedagogy and kind of started connecting with it and was like, wait a minute, this is the thing.
Right. So when I moved to California, so my background is military. So I'm a military spouse. So when I moved to California, it was a cultural shock for me. I saw like so many different things and I've experienced so many different things around the world. And then when I got to California, I'm like, wait a minute, this is really different, really different. Mm-hmm. So once we got here, like I said, it was a cultural shock. And I started to like wanting to engage in cultures. I've always loved diversity. I've always loved culture, but I've only been like boxed into certain cultures because I wasn't exposed to it. So once we moved here, it was like a huge melting pot of beauty. There was so many beautiful people, so many different people. And so I started to acquire new friends. I started eating new foods, going new places, learning Spanish, learning Tagalog, learning Mandarin, learning all types of different languages. And I'm like, wow. And so then when I signed back up for school to work on my doctoral degree, I started hearing about culturally responsive. I'm like, what's that? So it was like 2017. So I'm like, what is that? But we moved to California in 2014. So I got to experience diversity more so in 2014. And so then when I went back to school, we started hearing about culturally responsive. And then as I started looking into the literature, I started hearing about culturally relevant. But there was nothing about culturally sustaining until mm-hmm. later on. And so as I'm looking and I'm reading the literature, I'm like, I've been living this. I've needed this. My students mm-hmm. needed this because I was teaching in a classroom. So mm-hmm. I just dove deep into it. When I say dove deep, I have 6 bookshelves in my home filled. All of these books have to say culture. They have to say culture, or they say ethnicity, or they say something about religious studies. Mm-hmm. So I started to just really build my repertoire, build up my brain and try to understand how these two terms, culturally responsive and culturally relevant, could help my students. But there was a void. So every book that I read said K-12. Yep. It very rarely said preschool or early childhood education. And so that was my dissertation, was on educators' experiences affirming culturally responsive, relevant, and sustaining pedagogy. Mm. So I wanted to see who was doing this. Is anyone doing this in preschool? Is anyone doing this in early childhood education? And it was so sparse. It was hard for me to find people who were doing this, and if they were doing it, they didn't really put the whole essence of it, the whole relevancy, the whole responsive, and the whole sustaining. Yeah. So I would say that just the experience of culture alone and working in the early childhood education field really drove me to wanting to explore and to implement it in my classrooms. Mm-hmm. And as I started doing research, that's when I found out about Django Paris culturally and Sami Alim culturally mm-hmm. sustaining pedagogy. And I'm like, wait a minute. So in education, we're always trying to change our students. But what Django is saying and Alim is saying is that we need to sustain who they are, keep what they are and add to their repertoire, add to who they are. We shouldn't have to change anyone. Because that's what makes you beautiful. That's what makes you who you are. That's what makes you that independent individuality, right? Yeah. So I just felt like in my thesis and my dissertation, you can't have one without the other. You have to have responsive, relevant, and sustaining. All three have to go together. So yeah.
That gave me chills. I was like, ooh, yes. Yes to all of that.
Yes.
Because in my experience, I've heard a lot about culturally relevant, culturally responsive, but that, as you're mentioning, that sustaining portion of it, I haven't really heard much of that, and that's not a narrative that I've been super familiar with. But as you're talking, it makes so much sense.
Yeah.
There's so much more to it. Yeah. You know, when we're talking about diversity and culture and all these different really amazing things that are necessary, there's a lot of nuance to the conversation as well. Mm-hmm. You know, as we kind of just mentioned, it's not just about having a teacher that looks like you. Yes, it's amazing to have teachers who reflect your experience. It's amazing to see that. But it's not just that alone, right? There's so much more nuance, and there's so much more things that are deeper than just that surface level. Yes. And that sustainable portion of it is,
Yes.
So integral.
Absolutely. I have to say that doing like the interviews and talking to other teachers, even though, we're in a classroom, like in my classroom, there are all Hispanic students. And I would say mm-hmm. there was maybe out of the 22 students that we served in my classroom, one of them may have been African-American, and then 3 may have been identified as white. And mm-hmm. so the rest were Hispanic. I, as a teacher, said to myself, you're studying culturally responsive, relevant, sustaining. What are you going to do? Mm-hmm. So I learned Spanish. I had a parent, actually, she would stay with me from 4:30 p.m. till 6 o'clock p.m. and teach me common phrases in Spanish. She would also, tell me about her experiences, and I would tell her about my experiences. And so we got to know each other. I felt like that was the only way to reach and teach my students, was to make sure that I was equipped with some of their cultural artifacts, some of the things that they they experienced in their life, or that they spoke in their life, or that they ate in their life. We had times where we would have potlucks and the parents would bring food and I would bring food from my culture, and we would just sit and eat. Did I eat everything? No, because it wasn't for me, but I engaged and I enjoyed it. Also, they're, you know, working in the classrooms, you see teachers who are, they're like, I'm culturally responsive. And we're like, okay, well, tell me how you're culturally responsive. And so when someone says culturally responsive, now for me, I think of it as all three. So when a teacher would tell me they're culturally responsive, they'd tell me how you're culturally responsive. They're like, well, I put posters up in my classroom. I have books. I play music. Okay. Did you really get to know the students in your classroom? Did you really get to know their community? Did you really get to know what music they really listen to instead of stereotyping them? That's implicit bias. Did you really put these posters up of Africa? And have any of you guys ever been to Africa in this classroom? Have your students ever been? Are they identified as African? You know, and so we would just like stage classrooms. We're staging classrooms instead of making it really about students' cultures. And I found that it's because of implicit and explicit biases. Teachers either just don't want to acknowledge it, don't agree with it, so they don't incorporate it, or they feel like that's raunchy. Why would I do that in here? But that, if you want to classify it as raunchy, some music is a part, like Gloria Latin Billings. Hip hop music is my culture. That's my culture. You know?
Unrelated, but I have been loving more of like the early childhood kind of hip hop influenced songs that have been coming out. Gracie's Corner is just
Gracie's Corner. It's stuck in my head. Wait a minute now. It's stuck in my head. My nephew lives with me, and the other day he was listening and I just started dancing. He was like, what was it? Oh, good morning. Today's gonna be a great day. Good morning. Nothing's gonna get in your way. Nothing. And I look, he's 1 year old, and I look and he's dancing, literally doing the steps.
Yes.
And it embeds, right? That's your culture. It embeds into your subconscious and it becomes reality. And that's how it
feels. And it feels so affirming too. I hear those things and I think about, you know, we didn't back in my day.
Mine either. I didn't have it.
We didn't have these. And even like when I was, you know, in the classroom more often teaching, we didn't really have these kinds of preschool songs. You know, it was kind of that very kind of stereotypical, very, you know, which is still great. I mean, We Are the Dinosaurs. It's a bop. I love it.
I like that song too.
You know, it's a bop. We love it. But to know that we can have, you know, ABC songs that just kind of have a little bit of that, just that background to it, a little bit of that swagger to it that I'm used to. And it just, again, Gracie's Corner, I played that I Love My Hair song for my niece, and she was just dancing and grooving. She was like, this is nice. And
doesn't it make you feel good? Like before, we were taught to be ashamed of our hair, to be ashamed of our weight. To be ashamed. I have, for the listeners, I have vitiligo. So I used to be darker. And I remember like people like joking about me and talking about me and being very, very rude. I saw Gracie's Corner. I'm like, she has a girl in there with vitiligo. What? As an adult, I'm like, yes.
we love to see it. It feels good to see that. Even as an adult, it feels really good to see it. I love those videos. Of like deaf kids who will go to Disneyland and you'll see the characters signing with them and you just see this big smile on their face. Yeah. Like, wait, you mean Donald Duck can sign to me? Mickey Mouse can sign to me?
Yeah.
And it's those types of experience that just feel so affirming and feel like, oh, I'm seen. Oh, like I belong.
Now imagine integrating that into a classroom. Imagine the impact.
The impact is... it's phenomenal. It's phenomenal when we're able to do it and you see the students' faces and you see, you know, the parents being able to engage in a very meaningful way.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating and beautiful experience. And it's one of those things of why not?
It is. I have to tell you. Why would we not want? I had four generations of children in my classroom, and the mom told me that the reason she brought all four generations of her kids was because she said, I've never seen a child cry when I took them out of the classroom. She said, they usually cry when I leave them. She has a lot of kids. She has seven. So she's like, every time I left my children in the schools, they would cry for me to come and get them. It was just hard. She's like, but I leave my son with you and he's crying when I come and pick him up. He doesn't want to leave. And he goes, Miss Erica, help. And she said, that touched my heart. She's like, I want to know what she's in here doing. Is she giving my child candy? What's going on? So she said, I spent those. She's like, I know that you thought that I was coming because I didn't trust you. She's like, I was coming because I wanted to see why he loved you so much. Mm-hmm. And she said, and then I fell in love with you. I'm like, oh. And she said, that's why you got all four generations of my kids, because I trust you. And because you make them feel comfortable to be who they are. You don't tell them no. And if you do tell them no, you give them a reason why it's a no. But it's never really that solid no. It's a not right now. Not right now, you know? So it just made me feel good. And that was like my second year teaching. And that's when I started doing like the culturally responsive and relevant. But it made a difference. It made a difference in the community. It made a difference with my parents. It made a difference with my students. And even the teachers. Even the teachers, they started to shift their train of thought. And they started to see that they had some biases. You know, and they're like, Erica, what do we do about this? One of my teachers, she's really religious, right? She's really religious. And she's like, I'm not going to read a book about two parents being same sex. And I'm like, oh, that's a hard one. That's a hard one. If a kid brings it into the classroom, you're going to hurt him and tell him no.
Yeah.
And that's his reality in his home. Yeah. So we've had some challenges with the culturally responsive, relevant, and sustaining portion of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that brings me to a lot of the dialogue that I'm hearing in education right now. A lot of that kind of general pushback against, you know, this type of topics in classrooms and inclusivity and diversity in classrooms. I think the mentality is that educators are bringing all of this in and, you know, we're telling kids that they have to grow up and be gay and all these other different things when that's really not the reality. That's not the reality of what we're doing. I, you know, I have to fight with the kids on a regular basis to stand in line. So you think I have the fact that you think I have that much power control. Amazing.
Calm bodies.
Calm bodies. Walking feet, friends. Walking feet. You know, like, it takes me several months to get them to put things away where they belong. So
the picture's right there, kids. Come on.
The picture's on the shelf. Go put it where the picture is. So yeah, we don't have that much power and sway.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Not at all. But then it goes to that inclusivity piece, because I remember working in a classroom and I did have, you know, it was at a Jewish school and we had, you know, so many different colors of children and so many different families of children. And, you know, we had children with this beautiful kind of olive skin tone and these beautiful curly hair. And all the pictures in the classroom were of, you know, white Jewish children. And all our books were of like white Jewish children with like one mom and one dad and the 2.5 babies. And that was the reality of what these kids were looking at. But what about, you know, my child in my classroom that has two dads?
Yeah.
You know, what are we telling them about what a family looks like? What are we telling them about what being Jewish looks like?
You know,
all these it's unsaid things.
You know, that DAP, that developmentally appropriate practice, really comes into play. That book really needs to be redefined, reevaluated, and rewritten. I think as we experience different things in life, we need to update, we need to change. We're not asking educators to change who they are interpersonally when they go outside of the classroom. But when you come inside the classroom, you're putting on a different hat. You don't necessarily have to agree with it. Just like you don't agree with everything that's in our textbooks, you don't agree with the way that they tell you how to do math, you find another way to do it. So why not find another way to make a child feel comfortable, or to make a child feel loved, or to make a child not feel alienated? I think it's really important to just understand how you approach things and how you do things. And not everything is for everyone. Like, I don't eat meat. So for me, in my mind, I'm like, oh, that's disgusting, right? But when I go into the classroom, they tell me I have to taste it, because that's a family style dinner right there. Put it up to your mouth and pretend like you're eating it. So I pretend like I'm eating it. I find a way to do it. I don't eat it. I don't swallow it. But I go, ooh, it looks so good. Smell it. Wow, it's nourishing, huh? So I find a way. I don't eat it, though. So is it really that hard? Is it really that hard?
Is it really? I agree. So I know that you've done a lot of research around, what's the acronym for it? Because I think you said it was CRISP or...
I made that. Yeah.
Okay.
I made that one up. So I call it CRISP, Culturally Responsive, okay. Relevant, Sustaining Pedagogy, CRRSP. I made it up. I coined it. I call it CRISP because it's so fresh. It's so invigorating. It's like food for thought. It's something that you need in your life. It's something that you need as an educator in your classrooms. So I call it CRISP because it's crisp. It's a crisp topic.
Okay. It feels good to hear. It feels good to say. It feels good to experience. I love it.
It does.
I am for the crisp. It does. It does. So I know in your, you know, dissertation, you've been talking to educators who are either, is it all everyone who has been implementing a CRISP type study or someone who
Who has been, some of them knew, some of them didn't know, but they've been in a preschool setting and they've been implementing CRISP, but not entirely. So when we say implementation, like my studies found that it's not in its entirety. Because there's so much more to it. And again, like you said, sustaining is new and fresh to you. It's same with them. They're like, what's sustaining? I'm like, you're actually doing it, but you don't know that you're doing it, which was that questionnaire at the beginning that I gave them just to gauge to see if they were doing the relevant, responsive, and sustaining. Because I knew there were going to be a lot of people who didn't understand that sustaining portion or the relevant portion. They only really would focus on the culturally responsive.
And even in like the vocabulary of it, right? Like it tells you that there needs to be more. Like we can't just be responsive to culture. Like it exists all around us. It is a part of everything that we do. And I always say in my trainings, you know, you don't go into the classroom and just like shed your culture off and just go into the classroom as a blank slate of like nothingness. And the same thing, your students don't do that either. You walk around with your culture. It goes with you wherever you go. And you know, you just kind of carry that on your back. So you know, why would we not want to not only just be responsive to it, like, yes, we should be responsive, but also like, how are we being sustaining to our cultures?
Yeah.
You know, how are we being relevant? How is our curriculum being relevant to
rarely is it. You have teachers who they say, you know, the curriculum is a certain way. This is the way that we do it. I can't modify it. Well, yeah, you can modify it. You have to learn how to modify it for every student. That's a part of differentiating instruction, is to be able to modify your curriculum to meet the needs of all of your students. So you have some students that are tactile. You have some students that are visual. You have some students that are auditory, and so on. So how are you modifying? That's just the same as culture. So how are you modifying to meet the needs of the students? So you mean to tell me that when you're saying you're differentiating, you can't include a book with an African-American student in there or a Chinese student in there? They don't make books like that? They do. That's a part of being culturally responsive, relevant, and sustaining. If a student, if you don't have it, a student brings it in, then you read it. You talk about it. You discuss it. If a student comes and they're having a hard time because they're having issues at home, you sit there and you talk to them. That's a part of being culturally responsive. You also put students in the driver's seat of their own academic education and experiences. You let them be who they are and you shift your thinking and you shift your environment. You shift the way you are as an educator to meet them. A lot of the teachers say, I have 22 students. How can I do that? That's hard. How you expect me to change all of my toys out? You expect me to change my walls to meet all the cultures? You expect me to change my music? Well, if you are getting to know the families and you're engaging with the families, guess what? Like you said, their culture is on their back. It comes with them everywhere that they go.
Yep.
It doesn't mean you have to do all of that, but you should do some of that. But they can bring it in too. They can tell you who they are. You can spend a little time with them. They can bring some music in. You check it out, make sure it's developmentally appropriate for the students. Or you find Kids Bop in that musical tone. Or
if you're like me, you believe in the power of education and social justice. And what's more powerful than a good book? Today, I want to share an incredible way for you to support local independent bookstores while you indulge in your love of reading. Have you ever heard of bookshop.org? They're an amazing platform that connects readers just like us to independent booksellers all around the world. Local bookstores are essential for our communities. They foster culture, curiosity, and a lifelong love of reading. But they need our support to thrive, especially in this age of e-commerce giants. Bookshop.org is committed to helping those bookstores flourish. Every purchase you make on their site financially supports independent bookstores. That's right, every single purchase. They provide these stores with the tools they need to compete online and maintain their vibrant presence in our neighborhoods. They put their mission and public good above financial interests, giving over 80% of their profit margin to independent bookstores. That's a commitment you don't see every day. In fact, in 2020, they were recognized as the best of the world by B Labs, ranking in the top 5% of all B corporations. And guess what? It's written into their government's documents that they will never sell the company to Amazon or any major retailer. That's dedication to their mission. Plus, as a climate-neutral company, they're committed to operating sustainably. Another reason to feel good about your purchases. So if you're looking to buy a book and make a positive impact, head over to bookshop.org and use my affiliate link that's linked in my show notes below. By doing so, you'll be supporting local bookshops and helping them thrive. Let's make a difference one book at a time. Happy reading, and thank you for supporting our local bookshops.
Music name, and you integrate it into the classroom. It doesn't shift that far away from the truth of the song. So I think a lot of the educators that I've experienced and that I've interviewed, they don't understand that what they're doing, or they don't want to do it, or they don't know how to do it.
Yes. I think that's the biggest one that I hear when I'm out doing trainings. I get questions like, you know, they'll go to a training and they'll get information, especially even like about anti-bias curriculum, which I like for the most part. I have some problems with it, but I have some things that I would edit about it, but overall, I think, you know, it's a great framework. But, you know, when I have people there asking these questions, like, okay, this is great information, but like, how do I do that in the classroom? I think because it's something like kind of new, we just think it's something you have to like really actively do, and you have to do all this, you have to learn and do all these different things. And it's like, not necessarily.
You know, one of the teachers was like, I'm not going to fake the funk. I'm like, fake the funk? She's like, yeah, that's like me being something I'm not. I'm like, it's not about you faking the funk here, lady.
It's about expressing that empathy, that compassion, and showing a genuine interest in the people in your classroom, right? Building that classroom community. And that's exactly what it is. Your classroom is a community of people together. So you have your students and their families. Again, they're carrying that cultural component of them on their back. They're learning a lot just by being in the presence of other cultures and other things. And really that number one big thing that you can just start to do in your classroom is just be curious.
Yeah.
You can just start asking questions.
Yeah.
You know, listen. What? I had this for dinner last night. What did you eat for dinner last night?
What does it taste
like?
Let's
talk about it.
What does it taste like? What did you go? Tell me about that. Mm-hmm. Like, what did you guys do there? Or, and then sometimes, you know, I think one of the biggest issues too that we're seeing in the classrooms is this religious aspect. So most of the schools here in California and even in Ohio, and I used to live in Chicago, you couldn't talk about religion. And but you have some of the students that come into our classrooms is so deeply embedded. And so how do you not talk about it? How I had a student who was Muslim and he had to pray at a certain time. And so that's a part of his religion, right?
Yeah.
Or spiritual practice. So how do I say no? I'm not going to say no. Yeah. So if we allow him to do that, then we should allow little Bobby to talk about where he went on Sunday to the church, you know? But they really shun away from that religious aspect. But that's a part of culture. Like, I was raised Baptist and then Pentecostal, then Christian, then back to Baptist. So that comes with all of it, comes with me. Mm-hmm. How do you tell me that I have to shut that off?
Yep.
Yeah.
It's an interesting conversation because I think it does, people like to shut it off or they don't like to talk about certain religions. And that's kind of that one thing in anti-bias too, where religions come to play. And it's like, well, you know, we live in the United States. It's primarily Christian. And that's primarily what our holidays are centered around. And our, you know, we get, you know, winter break, and that's around Christmas, right? Yeah. We don't really get a break during Ramadan, and that's a really big.
I celebrate Kwanzaa.
And so there's, you know, there's all these different things. And so why are we not able to kind of talk about that? We, I mean, part of this practice I really see is just looking at our cultures, and they're going to exist, right? Like your culture does not have to be the same as mine. And it's allowed to exist. You're allowed to, you know, believe and express in your ways, and I'm allowed to believe and express in my ways. And I think the primary idea here is to just be able to show that appreciation, show and model that curiosity, that cultural humility for other people, and really just ask genuine questions. That's a really easy way to get started. You don't need any extra materials. You don't need to go out and buy anything. You don't need to read all these like heavy, dense textbooks. The first thing you can do is just start with that curiosity.
So I was talking to another scholar and researcher and a professor of mine, and she was like, well, what would you suggest, Erica? Like, how do you suggest a teacher actually approach this? And I think, well, not that I think, I know, and you said anti-bias training. I think that a lot of the educators come into our classrooms, even beyond preschool, K-12 schools, they have a lot of biases, explicit and implicit, right? They're just there. And so how do we screen our educators? How do we know that they're not bringing this into our classrooms? How do we screen them to see if they're biased or if they're racist? Or if they have something that's going to get in the way of them teaching a certain curriculum or incorporating culturally responsive, relevant, and sustaining. We can train you all day, but that doesn't mean that you're going to do it. We need some responsibility measures. Like, are you really doing it? All right, let me see that you're doing it. Show me how you're doing it. And now we're going to train you every 3 months to make sure that you understand what it is, why it is, and how it is. You know, it's just, there's no, you know, like the Department of Education says that we have to have certain trainings to maintain our teacher credential, or to maintain, you have to have a certain amount of hours to maintain your certification. Why is that not mandated? You mandate me to take CPR. Why don't you mandate me to incorporate things like culturally responsive, relevant, and sustaining pedagogy? I think it should be mandated that teachers take training like every 3 months. And they're screened before they come into this field for racism, bias, implicit bias, explicit bias. But we don't have that.
We don't. And it's hard. It's heart wrenching sometimes because you do, you know, I've been in classrooms and I've observed practices and, you know, again, teachers, if you have an internal bias, a lot of people aren't really aware of it. They're just kind of going through their life, not being fully aware that even they have this bias or they're treating students this way. That one study, the IVE movement study, where they asked, you know, the educators to find the student that was misbehaving. And what they were doing was like tracking their eyes, and like almost every teacher
looked at the
was watching the little black boy. And was looking for that challenging, risky behavior from that student. And again, you wouldn't even be aware of that. You wouldn't even be thinking that that's, you know, something that you would do. You know, I know I've had to confront my own biases in so many different ways. And each time I've been like, whoa, okay.
Check this out.
Let's take a step back. That is a bias that I did not know I had. We've got a little bit of work to do. And it's not easy work by any means. You know, it's not easy work to do. But I can 100% say that I am a better teacher the more that I work on my biases, the more that I take that step back and look at my own identity. All of my trainings, when I go into anti-bias type of trainings, they all start with, I don't even talk about the bias yet. I don't even talk about that stuff yet. I just talk about identity, and I just focus on the individuals in that classroom and that individuals in that, you know, room. Let's talk about your identity. Let's talk you first.
How can I know who you are if I don't know who I am? And you have that in a lot of the African American community because of everything that's happened in our past, right? It just resurfaces, and we still live in it. We're still experiencing it. A lot of us don't know how to identify. Don't know who. I'm not saying identify as I'm African American, I'm Black, But tell me who you are. I am smart. Yes. I am educated. I am bold. I am beautiful. I am courageous. I come from, my parents were born in Atlanta, Georgia. You know, like dig deep. I had to really find myself and wound up finding myself in the corner crying like a little baby, releasing all this trauma. Mm-hmm. And once I found myself, that's when I came into this education field. I was able to be able to tell people who I am and to accept who they were, because it adds to me. You are adds to me. I get to learn more stuff, experience more food. Not everything is for me, but at least I can say I tried it and I still respect it. It's just not something I'm going to do every day. But you have teachers who don't know who they are. They don't know who they are.
Yeah. And that makes it a lot trickier to do this work, right? To lead with authenticity and lead with that vulnerability and lead with that empathy and curiosity, right? Again, I know that I'm a better teacher. The more of this kind of work I continue to do, the more work that I do internally on my own self, right? Because in the beginning of my teaching journey, that wasn't great, you know, like most people aren't, you know, great the first year you start.
There's a lot of learning. That was horrible.
There's a lot of learning that we do in those first couple of years. You know, it's one of those fields that you do some observations through like your training, but it's nothing like, you know, this is your classroom, you do the thing now, and you're like, oh, okay, well,
you know, I find like a lot of the classrooms are so controlled. They're so controlled. Like teachers really don't have a sense of independence in their classrooms. And if they do, they're like sneaking to do it, or, you know, it's these, it depends on where you go. Like, it's so controlled. It just doesn't make any sense, which is, I'm like, I have to, certain places that I've worked, I'm like, I gotta go. They're like, nah, you can't have this book. Or you come into your classroom, you're like, what happened here? And they're like, oh, I took all that stuff out. Oh, okay. You took my African flag out, but you left the American flag, but that's part of who I am. Like, I know it. I know my history. I know my ancestors. I know. Mm-hmm. So I just find that it's just in the classrooms, you very rarely can do certain things. You very rarely can say certain things. It's just like so robotic.
It's getting more complicated. It's, depending on where we work, especially in California, we have different designations of, you know, schools and all of that. And it is kind of confusing. It's great in some ways because parents who can't afford it, and that's the big asterisk there, right? Parents who can't afford it have a lot of options for different pedagogies. Do you want to go to Reggio? Do you want to find Montessori? Do you want dual immersion? Do a dual language immersion? There's so many different great options, right? And you can find the option that works best for your child and your family. But again, voice and choice. Not everyone is awarded that option, right?
Let me tell you, I'm glad you said that. I had a conversation today with a friend who is in the military, and she called me and she's like, congratulations, Dr. Dallas, and just talking to me. And so I said, and she has a wife. And so I said, well, how, and they just had a baby, right? And so I said, well, how's everything going? And she's like, great. And I said, well, what are you doing? And I always ask her about education. I'm like, what school does she go to? And she's like, well, I have her to childcare. I have her to Montessori school. And she's at the Military Child Development Center. I was like, look at that diversity.
Yes.
And so looking at her child and hearing her child, you're just like, oh, you're well-rounded. She gets a little bit of everything that education has to offer, because her mom has her all three of these places because she's military and she works a lot. But that for me was just like, wow. Not too many kids are privileged to have that. And if they have it, they have it. This one time I'm going to this school, my mom took me out and then she put me in this school. No, this child goes through the week, those three different places.
Wow.
And it shows, her education shows. Whereas when I talk to like some of my nieces and nephews, they live in the hood. They live in the hood and they go to school in the hood. They go to my old school in the hood. Mm-hmm. I can tell the difference from other kids that don't go to the schools that I used to go to, that my nieces and nephews go to. And why is that? Just because they live in the hood doesn't mean they have to have this type of education. But when you go into the classrooms, you're like, okay. What? It just looks so unnatural. Even though it's in the hood, it's just like they're stepping into this zone where nothing represents them. And the teachers are so nonchalant and non-caring. They have this mindset that my nieces and my nephews, because they live in the hood and they grew up in the projects, or they grew up in these bad areas, that's what they're going to be. That doesn't mean that. That doesn't mean that. And that's not what culturally responsive, relevant, and sustaining pedagogy means. A lot of people are like, I'm supposed to sustain that they're this or that. No, now you're categorizing them. Now you're being implicit or explicitly biased, and you're being racist. So I'm not saying that that's what culturally responsive, relevant, and sustaining is. What it is you, the child tells you how they want to learn. The child tells you how they learn best when you're incorporating this into the classroom. I'm not saying you have to bring cursing rap music in. Like you said, kids bop. I'm not saying you have to accept that they have these lifestyles in the home, but when they get into your classroom, how can you make them feel comfortable? How can you make them feel loved? How can you look at them differently because they don't have on the same shoes as other kids? It's okay. That's a shell. How can you tap in deeper into their heart, into their mind, to actually incorporate that into the classroom? This is a different world when they step into your classroom, but their culture still comes with them, like you said. Culture still comes with them. Don't label me.
It's always there.
Yeah. Don't label me.
And it's, in addition to all of those things too, like it's looking at these children at a deficit, right? We're not going in, they're not coming into our presence as these, you know, these just vessels of learning, these vessels of possibility of so much that they can be, do, become. We're not looking at these children in this way. We're kind of looking at them as, oh, well, they're growing up in this environment, so that's exactly what they're going to become. It's like,
but that's what's happening.
We treat them that way.
That's
the way we think about them.
Look at the research.
That's what we're doing.
Look at the research. Look at the statistics. I'm telling you, it happens in the Hispanic community as well. It's it's just, we expect them to be a certain way or to think a certain way. Or I remember a time, my first year, remember we talked about like our first year was like horrible when we came into education. I remember we went to this big parent meet and greet to meet our parents, and they could meet us as teachers. And I remember one of the teachers came over to me and she's like, whispered something to me. And she's like, you're not going to understand anything that she says. And so I was like, okay. I was like, why? Cause she's speaking Spanish. She was like, no, she speaks broken English. And then I thought like, I speak broken English. Like, seriously, like I speak different. I code switch. I learned a code switch when I came to California. And so I was just thinking, I'm like, okay, well, whatever. So when the parent came over and she was talking to me, I was like, I understood every single word she just said. I'm like, what is this lady talking about? But I understood everything that she said, and those things that I didn't understand, I asked her to slow down and clarify. She talked really fast like me. But then I understood what she meant, where she was coming from, not just from her vocalization and verbalization, but from her body movements. She really moved like I move. Like when I get serious, I move my head, my eyes get big. Sometimes I bob my head to the left if it's an attitude. I bob my head to the right if it's a laugh. So I could identify with her movements and the way that she was. And she was actually Hispanic and African American, but the teacher told me that she was Hispanic. And so there you go. This is what we have. And it didn't stop with her. Other teachers, when another lady stood up in the room to talk, another teacher grabbed the microphone and said, what she means is, and I'm like, no, she said what she meant. You understood what she said. You know, like you have these types of teachers coming into the classroom where how you talk isn't acceptable. Cause you don't have that Eurocentric terminology. You don't have that Eurocentric curriculum terminology, but you understood exactly what I said. Sometimes I'll say words like I'm living in Ohio again, and people will look at me and I go, yeah, I said that. Yeah, that's what I said. You understood that. But you have that. You have that in our classrooms. You have these types of teachers that they're just like, let me correct how you just said that. If you could correct how I said it, you understood what I said.
Snaps, just immediate snaps.
So I just, how do we get this? How do we get?
I need that on my wall. I'll put that as my background on my phone. Just like there it is.
I'm telling you, my experiences in the classrooms has just been interesting.
Yes. And so we've talked about, we kind of talked about these different layers of culture, right? So we've talked about culture as language, which is really, really important. It's, you know, obviously how we communicate with each other, and we're all going to communicate in different ways, and we're all going to find, you know, just different avenues of communication, and that might be verbal, that might be your body language, that just might be the way you're holding yourself, or, you know, whatever that looks like. And culture is in our music, culture is in our food. And these are all excellent ways to incorporate that into our classroom, incorporate these conversations, incorporate, you know, different types of styles of music into it, even styles of dress into it, and just talk about those types of things. What do we think might be other layers of culture that, you know, we might kind of bypass? Because again, culture is something that is, it's nuanced. There's a lot of nuance to culture. It's not quite a straight shoot. It's not as straightforward as we would prefer for it to be. There's a lot of nuance and a lot that goes into it. But what are other ways we think in early childhood education, especially, that we can look at culture and embrace culture and bring that into our classrooms in a way that is, as you say, it's affirming, it's responsive, it's relevant, it's sustaining?
So Zaretta Hammond, Goldie Muhammad, and Shiroki Holly, they wrote books. Zaretta Hammond was Culturally Responsive in the Brain, I believe. Don't quote me on that one. Goldie Muhammad was Cultivating Genius, and Shiroki Holly was culturally and linguistically responsive teaching and learning, classroom practices. So when you think about all three of those other books, right, you have your other scholars, you have your responsive, relevant, sustaining, but then you have these other aspects. So what Zaretta Hammond is saying is that it's internalized, it's in the brain, you know, and then here's the steps to do this. Here's the steps to helping the teachers change the environment, change the way that they're thinking, change the curriculum in a way, but it all starts in the brain. And then you have Goldie Muhammad, Cultivating Genius. So Goldie Muhammad's like one of the newest scholars. I really have not really gotten really into her book, but she also says something about cultivating yourself, cultivating your life as a teacher. You have to cultivate yourself into that culture. And then Shiroki Holly says that if you have students, and this isn't just what he says, but he's saying, if you have students in your classroom that speak Spanish, learn some phrases in Spanish to be able to make them feel comfortable. Also, it's about like the students. You we're saying we have dual language classrooms where in the classroom we're teaching the students English, right? Well, we have different dialects. So we have teachers that are in the classroom, they do speak Spanish, but their dialect is different. You have a lot of teachers that say, my Spanish is broken. Or I speak, what was it? One of the teachers told me she speaks, I forgot. But she basically was telling me that she doesn't really speak Spanish that well. Even though she is Hispanic and everyone in her family speaks Spanish, she's like, because of where we came from, our Spanish isn't that well. And so I'm like, well, you came from Mexico. She's like, yeah, but because of her history and her family history, their Spanish is a different dialect. So I'm like, there's different dialects of Spanish. So we're telling students, you're coming into this classroom, you're in a dual language classroom where there's English and Spanish spoken, but is the teacher really equipped with that dialect? Yeah. Like, are they really equipped with that version of Spanish that student needs? So what Shiroki Holly is saying is that if we're going to do these dual language classrooms, if we're going to have students in these dual language classrooms learning to speak English, we have to understand the kind of Spanish that they're speaking, sustain it, and then add to their repertoire. But the teachers have to be on the same page. So you're just putting Spanish speaking teachers in there. You're not really understanding if they're able to reach and teach these students based on the dialect of the Spanish or Mandarin or however, whatever language it is. So there's so many different components to it. It's not just, it doesn't just stop at responsive, relevant, and sustaining, right?
Yes.
There's the little nuances that's in between it. Because Shiroki Holly worked close with Gloria Lassen-Billings and Geneva Gay. And so that's where he came up with his theory about the linguistics version of it. You have to incorporate that as well. And he also said something about Ebonics. And this was the first time I've ever seen, and it's probably been there, but this is the first time I've ever seen a scholar talk about Ebonics. And I'm like, wait a minute, I know what that means. I know all these words. That's a... But can we really speak that in the classroom? Is that really a dual language? Cherokee Holly's saying yes. It is a language. But again, we have those teachers that are like, I'm not going to let you walk into my classroom and say, what's up? But I can say, hola. I can say, konnichiwa. I can say, swadika. Why can't I say, what's up? There's the bias. There's the implicit bias, right?
It's there. Yeah.
It's there. It's,
I've also been hearing a lot of this kind of conversations around, what is it, African-American vernacular English, the AABE. And, you know, the more I watch these types of, you know, videos, the more that I kind of hear it, it just, it feels comforting to me. It feels like, oh yeah, I just feel like I'm at home at a cookout right now.
Like it just feels free.
It feels so freeing, and it feels like, oh, I don't have to enunciate this special way, or I don't have to use this particular language. And that's also a part of that identity comportion of that, of I don't have to hide, you know, as we just said, like that code switching. Mm-hmm. I don't have to hide an aspect of my identity when I'm in certain situations, when I'm in, you know, certain company. I get to just talk in a comfortable way. I get to just be who I am and express myself in that way that I don't always get to express.
Yeah.
And that says a lot, right, about how we view certain things and people who are English language learners, how they're not viewed as.
But are we all English language learners? I mean, is that, that's an argument, right? We all are English language learners.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that. I believe we're all.
I believe it too. I think we're, you know, English is, it's a really hard language. There's a lot that goes into English, and I feel like I'm constantly learning either just new words, or I'm learning new ways, or even we're just changing things. We're constantly adding new things to the dictionary.
They just added some new words.
They added some new words and syntax and word. Like there's so many different things that we don't even think about.
Yeah.
And especially with this conversation around pronouns, it's clear that people don't know what a pronoun actually is. They're like, they're teaching them pronouns in schools. And I'm like, well, yeah. It's a part of the English language. I don't know what to tell you about. You gotta pull your kids out of the school if they're talking about pronouns. Like,
yeah, people are gonna really, yeah, they have a lot to say about that. I just stay out that conversation. I'm like, hey, that's y'all. Y'all can have that. A lot of the other day I called my professor. I'm like, girl, just like that deep girl, like, you know, like, girl. She was like, hello? Hello, this is Dr. I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. Whoops.
My bad. Forgot to switch.
Let me code switch back to you. I made a mistake.
Sorry, we're in academia. My bad. Let me rewind a little bit.
We even need it in our universities. But now I'm not saying in my papers I'm going to be like, you know, talking my vernacular. I'm just saying, like, sometimes we ask so much of a person that you can only fake the funk for so long. So it's just like, okay, let me free, let me out. It's like being closed into this tight shirt, zipped up.
Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I could talk to you for literal hours. So.
I'll come back.
Come on back, because I have so many other questions. I feel like we only scratched the surface.
Yes. Just
but the last question I have for you is the question that I want to ask all of my guests, and that is, how do you reimagine education? What does the future of education look like to you?
I think the future of education is less structured, more authentic, very inclusive, incorporating of culturally responsive, relevant, and sustaining pedagogy, and blended and in aspects of incorporating lots of linguistics into our classrooms, where it's not just English, it's not just Spanish, but it's other languages, and the teachers are speaking different languages, and they've had these types of trainings to help them teach and reach students. So that's how I see it.
I love it. Let's get crispy in schools,
right? Bring it on.
Bring it on. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Dallas, for joining me today on the Conscious Pathways podcast. I honestly look forward to having you on again and just deepening these conversations. Yeah, this has been amazing.
Yes, I agree. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. I'll come back anytime. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Conscious Pathways podcast. Don't forget to join us on Instagram to join the conversation. And we'll see you next week for more transformative conversations in education. Bye.